Christmas is coming. Woohoo! Yay! Oh, it's been a long wait. I'm sure in my daughter's room, who's 10, there's a list of, 340 days being marked off to the next Christmas. She's looking forward to it. I don't know about your family, but one of the biggest challenges we have in my family is figuring out what are we going to do for Christmas lunch. There's that old saying, you are what you eat. Well, you haven't had Christmas lunch at our place until your belt has moved at least one notch. This saying, you are what you eat, is something that rolls off our tongues fairly easily, isn't it? But the idea is pretty simple. Whatever we take into our bodies affects how we function. If you eat well, you live well. That's the whole idea. But as we all know, food on the plate just isn't food on the plate. It says a whole lot more about our heritage, our backgrounds, our skills, our capacity, our wealth, our prosperity. I don't know if you've seen any of Heston Blumenthal's feasts. He recreated some of those early Tudor kind of feasts, including roast swan. Can you imagine? It was quite extraordinary. But watching that roast swan get paraded down through this big banqueting hall made me think, I wonder what the other half of England feasted on at Christmas time. It's been a centenary year for a lot of remembrances around World War I. I was shocked and surprised to discover that of all the men who volunteered to serve when war broke out in England, something like 40% of men were refused because of the effects of malnourishment. 40% could not serve because as a child growing up, they didn't have enough to eat. On the other side, the officers were on average 10 to 15 centimetres taller than the average digger. You are what you eat. But it's not only food that reflects this reality, it's also a deeper spiritual reality. Or to put it in another way, you become what you love. You become what you love. And what loves you shapes the kind of person that you become. It shapes your values, it shapes your decisions, it shapes your priorities. What you love shapes your direction in life. This is what Jesus' parable about the sheep and the goats is all about. It's a parable that's darkly humorous. I mean, Jesus was Jewish after all. It kind of has that sharp edge to it, doesn't it? Because it's a parable that both comforts us, but leaves us feeling pretty queasy and uncomfortable all at the same time. A lot of folks read it as a blueprint for the day of judgment, but I wonder if Jesus is trying to make a point, not so much about the good place or the bad place, so much as what do people think about God? What is it that they really love? And what consequences flow from that decision? Like many of Jesus' parables, this one begins by Jesus comforting the afflicted. It's like Jesus says, picture a scene in heaven. Picture millions and millions of people from all the countries of the world, all gathered around the people of Israel. Everyone gathered there is waiting for the king to speak. And then all of a sudden, the people begin to get separated into one group and into another, to the left and to the right, the sheep and the goats. A great sorting happens. And I'm sure in a voice that sounds like Brian Blessed, you can imagine this big booming voice come over. Come, you who are blessed by the Father. Take your inheritance prepared for you since the creation of the world. And everyone there knows what's going to happen next. Israel, God's loyal and long-suffering people, the people who followed the law, never backed down, never given in. They are the ones who are going to get the front row seat in God's kingdom. And all those good-for-nothing Gentiles, all those folks who just lived as they please, well, they are just toast. Stick a fork in them, they're done. But who does God welcome? What does Jesus actually say? Listen carefully. I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a foreigner and you gave me a room. I was vulnerable and ashamed and you clothed me. I was sick and of no value to anyone, but you cared. I was locked away and forgotten, but you stopped by. Now you can imagine Jesus' hearers thinking, what? That's not the way the story goes. To the minds of those who would have been listening to Jesus, you can imagine them thinking, well, getting into heaven, that's for the right kind of people. And to be the right kind of people, you've got to be one of the children of Isaac. Sorry, Ishmael, you're just not going to make it. Getting into heaven, well, that's for men who would keep God's law faithfully. I'm sorry, ladies, that's just the way the story goes. It was for those who were correct about God, those who had the best theology, those who were right. I'm sorry, all you good Anglicans, you just wouldn't make it either. Heaven was the reward for people with the most devotion, the people who were at the top of their game, people who never buckled, never compromised, never backslid, were never wayward, stupid, or sinful. That's who was supposed to get into heaven. But what does Jesus say? Does he make any mention of circumcision? No. Is there any mention of keeping the Ten Commandments or all the food laws? I had bacon for breakfast, I'd be out. Does he say anything about following God's design? Does he say anything about men being leaders and women being submissive? No, nothing. Nada. Zilch. Nothing about all the usual markers that we would think about what it means to get into heaven. Those who are declared righteous, those who are going to be let in, are just shocked at this announcement. Who? Us, they say. When did the prince become the pauper? This is not so much an exercise in disguise, so much as it is an expression of solidarity. You become what you love. And what made all the difference for these people was that they loved what God loves. It had nothing to do with their heritage or their piety or being right or being powerful, but it had everything to do with exercising human decency and treating the image of God in someone different with respect and with honour. God welcomes these people because they reflect God's own character. You become what you love. Now, of course, anyone who'd ever read the Old Testament would have figured out this is nothing new at all. Micah 6:8 puts it this way: do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. Our reading from Ezekiel makes this even clearer. God shows us what justice and mercy and humility look like and feel like. God is the one who seeks out the lost. He tends the injured. He strengthens the weak. And he deals with the bullies. The bullies who push everyone out of the way. The bullies who hog everything. The bullies who exploit the vulnerable and take advantage of the weak. Ezekiel says God knows how to deal with bullies. The only difference between the lean sheep and the fat sheep is not the food, it's who gets to eat. You become what you love. So while Jesus' parables comfort the afflicted, this one is also meant to afflict the comfortable. So the king says to the bunch on his left, and just let me paraphrase this for you, just so you get the real punch that goes with it. He says to them, "You let me starve. You left me to dry up. You left me in the streets. You left me feeling ashamed and afraid. You left me to rot alone and forgotten." And like all bullies, you can imagine these folks on the left begin to protest their innocence, begin to make excuses, and above all, whine about how unfair this situation is. Was it their fault that they couldn't see through God's disguise? These people could not see Jesus for one simple reason. They were so blinded by their own sense of entitlement that they couldn't see the needs of anybody else. This is it about bullies. Bullies are great at kissing up and kicking everybody else down. Bullies are great at whining about how unfair the world is, especially when they get caught. These are people who are so self-satisfied that everyone else is made to serve them. Their demands for company, their demands for clothing, their demands for housing, their demands for food and the best water available. Everyone served them. You don't have a country where 40% of the people are malnourished without the leaders of that country saying, "That's fine. I'm happy with that." This is the twist. When confronted by their mistake, their misunderstanding of God, their mistreatment of others, how does Jesus' audience, the Pharisees and those in power, respond? What do they do? Do they change their mind? Do they say, "Sorry, we'll do something different next time"? No. What they do in chapter 26 is they scurry off to the high priest's house, where they begin to plot a lynching for Jesus. That's their response. That's pretty sobering. It's a story that's supposed to be sobering because there's nothing to cheer about here. There is only separation and destruction. Now, for many of us, we can feel like, "God, that just sounds so unfair. How could you send anyone to a place of eternal destruction?" But think about it for a moment. You become what you love. These people so love themselves. What's the only way to love yourself? In isolation, separated from anybody and everybody else. It's the reality that any kind of good place would only ever feel like the bad place to these people. How could they possibly want to be with God when they've spent their whole life ignoring him? Today we're remembering Christ the King. And this story is central because we serve and we follow a king who does not come as a conquering hero, as someone who comes to dominate and control, someone who dishes out vengeance and payback. No, that's the kind of king that's adored by bullies and kiss-ups everywhere. The kind of king we follow is someone who came to sit with those who were shut out and left behind. He's the kind of king who draws alongside those who are too embarrassed to be seen. He comes to be with those who are easily forgotten. He comes to bring life to people who feel dead. He comes to bring peace to those who are in turmoil. While other kings send their people off to die, Jesus is the king who mounts the throne of the cross to die himself. And by doing so, he puts everything right. This is what Paul speaks of as to why Jesus is raised to sit in the heavenly places, far above all rule and power and authority and dominion. Paul doesn't mean for us to understand that Jesus is the strongest king, the most dominating, the most powerful king around. No, it's a picture to say that Jesus, self-giving, the nature of his kingship, which is grounded in his sacrifice, cannot be contained by any king upon this earth. No rule, no authority, no power, no dominion has that kind of capacity to change people's hearts, to change this world that we live in. That's the kind of king that we follow. You become what you love. This is the mystery of the incarnation. This is the tragedy of the crucifixion. This is the triumph of the resurrection. You become what you love. So if you find yourself sitting here this morning feeling uneasy and disturbed, perhaps wondering about which line you might be in, don't despair. Take heed of Jesus' warning. If you're worried about the kind of person you're becoming, look carefully at the things you love. If you don't like the path that you're on, you can change it. Jesus is not the kind of king who barks orders at us and then just expects us to get on with it. Jesus is the kind of king who jumps down into the hole with us to help us, to lift us up, to keep us going. So if you're worried that your heart is too hard or too small or too bitter or too angry, you're in good company. That's why we're here. We're not here in church because of the candles or the morning tea, which is wonderful, or even these long, boring sermons. We are here because we want to know how to love, to know that we are loved by the risen Lord, Christ the King, who comes as a friend and not as a conqueror. We're here to learn how to love and to be loved. And if we let ourselves be loved, you might just be surprised at what you might become.